Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Islamic State's murderous campaign of extinction of Sunni tribes, who the US and the Iraqi government have not come to the aid of, in spite of US plans to mount an offensive with Iraqi security forces. A former senior British intelligence officer, Richard Barrett, the co-author of a new report from the Sufan Group in conjunction with PBS's Frontline, The Rise of ISIS, joins us to discuss what attracts foreign fighters to join the Islamic State, which appears to be growing in numbers while expanding its hold on huge swaths of Syria and Iraq, with its fighters now encircling a large airbase in Anbar province and the critically important Haditha Dam, as well as the fertile irrigated areas near Baghdad. Then we'll examine the unprecedented and record-breaking influx of outside money and dark money into 10 critical Senate races with Ian Vanderwalker, counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Project, who is the author of a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. Outside money and dark money in toss-up Senate races. We'll discuss the roughly even amounts of outside money, $277 million for the GOP and $193 million for the Democrats as of last Wednesday, and the pro-Republican preference for dark money, which is at 76% of non-party spending compared to 35% for the Democrats. Then finally, we'll look into the U.S. Billionaires Political Power Index, which measures the recent election activism, campaign donations, and influence of America's billionaires leading up to Tuesday's midterm elections. The author of the report, Darrell West, the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, joins us to discuss the roles of Peter Thiel, Robert Mercer, Joe Ricketts, Paul Singer, and David Geffen, who have moved up the list, while others like Penny Pritzker, Warren Buffett, Pete Peterson, and Alice Walton have seen their rankings drop. And joining us now is Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Operations in Washington, and was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York. He is the co-author of the Sufan Group's new report in conjunction with PBS's Frontline, The Rise of ISIS. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
And this Islamic State, you describe in this report, I believe it was broadcast last Tuesday on PBS's Frontline, was it not?
Yeah, Tuesday or Wednesday. I was away at the time, unfortunately, but last week.
And what you in your report, you say that the Islamic State mixes the violent ideology and rhetoric of Osama bin Laden with the violent governing strategy of Saddam Hussein. The group is now a toxically powerful hybrid of Takfiri ideology channeled by Ba'athist organizational and administrative skills, resulting in a well-disciplined but independently motivated extremist group unlike any other. So what explains the fact that, for example, a Sunni tribe in the town of Hit, that been under siege by Islamic fighters now for some time, received no aid whatsoever, no airdrops from the either from the U.S. or the government in Baghdad, and they've all but been wiped out?
Well, indeed, yeah, that's a dreadful tragedy, and I think that one of the reasons that the Islamic State did that was really to impress upon other Sunni tribes that opposition to them is really not in their interest, that no one's going to come to their help, and that if they, as they inevitably will, lose the battle, then they'll just be massacred. So the best thing is to support the Islamic State. And, of course, you mentioned the sort of Takfiris, and you mentioned the Ba'athists who've joined together, but the other sort of leg of this stool, this three-legged stool, is the tribal support. Without Sunni tribal support, I don't think the Islamic State really could survive for very long. So they've got to ensure both that those who want to support them, and those who don't want to support them as well. And I think that the massacre of the Abu Nimr tribe at Hit was very much in that latter vein.
Well, exterminating these tribes, how does that win support? I mean, I thought this was something of an alliance of convenience because the Sunnis are so furious at the government in Baghdad. They may not believe in the all of the aims of this of the Islamic State, but they certainly they're absolutely fed up with the government in Baghdad. I mean, how deep is this support?
Well, you're absolutely right. Yeah, the Sunni tribes are absolutely fed up with the government in Baghdad, particularly under Nouri al-Maliki. Maybe they think in due course it might be better for them under the new administration there. But it remains a Shiite government, essentially a Shia government with a huge amount of influence from Iran. And therefore, in their view, not one that's going to be particularly helpful to their interests. And I think that the Sunnis tribes are also, they're very much intimidated by the Islamic State. And part of the reason, I think, why the Islamic State attacked the Abu Nima tribe in Hit was because they were part of the awakening movement back in 2006-2007, which, of course, really decimated what was then known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that is the same group as the Islamic State. So I think there was a certain amount of revenge, a certain amount of intimidation, and a certain amount of, we're doing this pour encourager les autres, as it were.
But what explains the fecklessness of the government in Baghdad, and particularly its military, who the U.S. is now, according to the New York Times, planning to mount an offensive with, but not till the spring, I mean, months away. So what explains why this army can't fight, whereas the Islamic State appears to be incredibly effective, and maybe it's because of the Ba'athist generals directing them, but at this point they control huge swaths of Syria and Iraq, and apparently their fighters are encircling a large air base in Anbar province and the critically important Haditha Dam, as well as the fertile irrigated areas near Baghdad.
Well, yes, indeed. I think that one of the reasons that the Iraqi army collapsed so much is that they ensured that all the Ba'athists, all the old people who were in the army in 2003 were forced to leave. And so there was no, well, okay, you had 10 years, but there was no sort of tradition of serving in the army. And the Shiite militia, in fact, became the backbone, I think, of al-Maliki's rule rather than the army. And the army seemed to develop into some sort of patronage system whereby the officers would get paid. They would take the money for phantom soldiers or not pay the soldiers, and their morale was low, and training levels were very low as well, despite all the effort that the United States put in to try to build up the army. So in a way, it wasn't so surprising that it didn't perform particularly well when the Islamic State moved into Mosul in June. And I think that in a way, they didn't expect that they would have to perform particularly well, because I think they thought that most of their problems were behind them. But now, you're right, it won't be until the spring that they can really mount any sort of decent offensive against the Islamic State. But I think it was the same story or another one today that said that Ray Odierno, the very senior military general there, reckoned it might be 4 or 5 years before the Iraqi army could really get rid of the Islamic State. Well, a hell of a lot can happen in 4 or 5 years, of course.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Operations in Washington, and was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York. He's the co-author of the Sufan Group's new report in conjunction with PBS's Frontline, The Rise of ISIS. So in your report, you point out that funding of the Islamic State is not particularly, it's been somewhat exaggerated how much they rely on foreign donors, and they've just apparently taken another gas field in Syria. But what you do say in the report, which I find quite extraordinary, is that in terms of foreign fighters, that's where the foreign component is truly significant. Foreign fighters account for perhaps 15,000 of the group's estimated 30,000 fighters coming from just five countries, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, Over half of them come from five countries: Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Morocco, and Turkey. There was a very interesting segment on CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday night about radical preachers in London recruiting Islamic State fighters. And I think that they said in that piece that about five a month are still coming from Great Britain to join the Islamic State. So what is it about this organization that attracts foreign fighters, in particular Europeans?
Yeah, it really is so interesting, isn't it, that these huge numbers are going over there. And I think it was even five a week, actually, that they were saying from the United Kingdom. And you think, well, what do they reckon they're going to get into? It's absolutely no doubt at all that if you leave for Syria now, you're going to end up with the Islamic State or with Jabhat al-Nusra, which is pretty much as bad. I mean, essentially, they're both al-Qaeda-type organizations. So what is it that's driving people? And I think people are managing to convince themselves somehow that the atrocities and the horrors are, in a way, justified, and that they don't need to get involved with that, because the appeal of the Islamic State to individuals in Europe who may feel disaffected, they may feel sort of alienated from society, they may sort of lack any sense of identity or purpose. And the Islamic State is saying, come and join us. You'll have a great future. You'll be part of something really important. You'll be building something. Don't worry about what you did before. You can leave all your past behind you. And you just get in with this. This is where it's happening. This is action. This is doing something. And this is how the world's going to be. Well, for you and me, that seems pretty ridiculous. But I think for many people who reckon that their future doesn't hold very much, it's quite an attractive option, and I reckon they think they can go there, and if it doesn't turn out too well, they can turn around and come back again, and I'm not quite sure that that second option is going to be so open to them.
Well, particularly because the Islamic State uses these foreign fighters, particularly the Europeans, for martyrdom operations while maintaining their mostly Iraqi core.
Yes, indeed. Let's look at the composition of the Islamic State. And as you say, there's an Iraqi core. There's quite a few Syrians, of course, also members. Then there's the rest of Middle East, North Africa, which provide a lot of the members, and Turkey, too, a regional country just over the border. And then you come down to the 400 or 500 from Germany, you know, the sort of 500 or 600 from Britain, the 900 or so from France. These are big numbers, of course, but they don't necessarily translate into influence over the Islamic State. The Islamic State is essentially still an Iraqi movement with lots of regional support. So those Europeans, I mean, probably they don't speak good Arabic. They're not particularly useful. They're not trained fighters. So what are they? They're sort of cannon fodder, or else they're going to be sent around patrolling the streets and looking after the rear, the logistics and stuff like that. They're all useful jobs, but they're not central to the success of the Islamic State.
So just in trying to understand the motivations and the attraction of this movement and the 60 Minutes piece on CBS on Sunday night was quite extraordinary, the extent to which demonstrations in the street by followers of the Islamic State and by their recruiters, in particular, they profiled a radical preacher in London. They were holding up signs, you know, saying that Islam will take over the world and dominate the world, etc. And of course, we, ironically, here in the United States, we have state legislatures in Kansas and Oklahoma preemptively passing anti-Sharia laws when there's absolutely no evidence of Sharia, even anybody talking about it here. But there you have on the streets of London real manifestations of a challenge to democratic society into the United Kingdom itself. And so it's an odd juxtaposition between fear, paranoia here in the United States that's completely unfounded, and a kind of extraordinary tolerance in England.
Well, that's right. I hope it is one of the aspects of our democracy in the United Kingdom that these people are allowed to speak like this on the street. Of course, they're extremely careful not to stray into incitement or other criminal activity, which might get them charged and locked up. But Yeah, I think we have to be open to freedom of expression, and of course there are very, very strong protections here of freedom of expression rights. And I guess if somebody stood up and said all that stuff, they get castigated and they get criticized, but they wouldn't necessarily be charged with anything, of course. And we have to remember, too, that the United Kingdom, just as here, this is a tiny, tiny number of people who are really getting involved in all this. We have a big Muslim community in the United Kingdom, and they are almost 99%, I would have said, opposed to that sort of rhetoric in the streets and stuff. They wouldn't like it at all and probably kick the guys out of the mosque if they got a chance. But you know, we have to have that open debate. And I think if you just suppress it, you're probably more likely to end up with radicalized people than if you allow people to sort of think, oh, yeah, that's interesting, but talk with their friends about it. And then the more people who go over to Iraq, Syria, and fight, and then go home again and say, well, it's not as we were told. It's just awful and terrible, and these people are just complete thugs. Then that's a very effective counter-narrative, of course, to the people who are saying, oh, yeah, Islam's the future. Of course, Islam may be the future, but certainly not the Islam that's practiced by people in the Islamic State.
Well, there's a good chance that those people will be arrested. They certainly tried to arrest some people recently in France. But just going back to the motivations and of these young fighters going over there to join this fight, and about 15,000 have already done that. It's not, I suppose, in the overall scheme of things, a huge number. But the kind of zeal, I've not sort of seen that kind of political zeal, not that I was around for the Bolshevik Revolution, but you get the feeling that this is a phenomenon akin to like the passion of the Trotskyites or something.
Well, yeah, I too just missed the Bolshevik Revolution. And but that's right. I mean, this is amazing. We didn't see anything like this with the Afghan campaign. I'm not sure that even people who you know, took part in Bosnia and some of those other fights, which were really did stir the emotions of many people, quite had the zeal and enthusiasm of the people going over to Syria. But these guys, what are they? They're sort of late teens, mainly, perhaps early 20s. You know, not many over 30, I wouldn't have thought. So they're still relatively young. They're still finding themselves. They're still thinking that they can believe in something, even though the facts may be rather pointing against it. So, you know, where's it going to go? I think it's going to be more and more evident to people that actually they can't close their eyes to the atrocities of these people, that it's not, you know, whatever they say, however they advertise themselves, it's not going to be like that. And people are going to be more and more poking fun at them, being satirical, being critical of them, and so on. And their Twitter feeds at the moment, all the films and the videos they send out from Syria and Iraq to make life look really, really superb, I think they're going to get balanced sooner or later by the reality, you know, the fact that actually these people can't run a state of 6 or 8 million people or however many now live under their suzerainty. So that it's not going to be the great future. In fact, it's just another misstep, I think, in the history of Al-Qaedism.
So does that therefore mean that the U.S. and the U.S. media should be a little less hysterical? And we have reacted, it seems, almost as passionately, if you will, for the want of a better description, than we did after 9/11. And that was in response to just a couple of Americans and British journalists being executed on camera.
Well, it's a great story, isn't it? It's very visual. It's very immediate. You know, as you say, the executions on camera and so on, the stills, even if not the videos, of people being massacred. You know, the idea of this sort of Mongol horde overtaking somewhere which is relatively close to us. What are the consequences of that? Then all the sort of questions about, well, why were we in Iraq? What did we do? Why didn't it work? You know, should we be going back? All these things I think, very real for the American public. And I think it's quite right that the media would both reflect that and encourage that. But it is, I think, at the end of the day, a story, so far as the United States is concerned. There is no real threat to the United States as a result of this, certainly to the stability of the Middle East and other things we're interested in, but not the United States itself. And I think that that's the important thing for people to remember, because the objective of terrorism, of course, is to make you frightened. It's not to kill you. And I think we need to be quite rational in our approach to this, to decide whether airstrikes are right, you know, how they should be followed up, how you can improve governance in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq, Syria, what you do about Bashar al-Assad. These are really, really difficult questions to answer. But I think we need to focus on those rather than the immediacy of, oh, my God, there's been another massacre.
Well, Richard Barrett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Operations in Washington, and was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York. He's the co-author of the Sufan Group's new report in conjunction with PBS's Frontline, The Rise of ISIS. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the unprecedented record-breaking influx of outside money and dark money into 10 critical Senate races. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Vanderwalker, who serves as counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where he works on voting rights and campaign finance reform. Prior to joining the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, he served as a legal fellow at the Center for Reproductive Rights, where he litigated constitutional cases in state and federal courts across the country. He is the lead author of a new report from the Brennan Center, Outside Money and Dark Money in Toss-Up Senate Races. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Vanderwalker.
Thank you.
And the report that you've done, and of course, it's a pre-election update, so the figures may well be changed. And in fact, my understanding is much of the advertising now pouring in is being timed to ensure that voters won't know who's paying for it until after the election, because the deadline for filing for PACs was October the 15th. Anything after October the 15th basically won't show up until after the election. So what are the chances of the appalling figures that you have given us being incredibly worse the day after?
Well, they're definitely going to be higher. I'm not sure how much higher. You know, in the past, we've seen that half or 75% of the spending comes in the last 4 weeks of the election. I'm not sure how much generally comes in the last week of the election, but I think the patterns that exist, we've seen, we know where the highs are going to be. We just don't know how high they're going to be.
So at this point, it looks as though in terms of outside spending, that the Republicans are slightly ahead of the Democrats. But in terms of dark money, there's a huge difference. The Republicans are over 2-1 in terms of preferring dark money.
Yes. More than 3/4 of the outside spending that favors Republicans comes from dark money groups that hide some or all of their donors. So, and it's only something like 35% for the pro-Democrat group. So it's a big difference in terms of the sort of transparency among the different parties.
But in terms of the 11 most competitive Senate races, so far there's, well, at least as of last Wednesday, there's been $328 million in spending by groups other than the candidates. and comparing that to the 2012 elections of 259. So that is a substantial increase.
Yes, outside spending, I mean, every year since the Supreme Court decided Citizens United and sort of opened these floodgates, every year has been a record-breaking year for outside spending. And this year, as compared to the last midterms, the candidate spending has actually stayed largely the same across all elections, but outside spending has increased, which means a greater percentage of this spending is coming from these groups that are not accountable and often not transparent.
And apparently a lot of these groups just lay dormant. They're just a shingle somewhere registered in either Delaware or Washington, D.C. No activity, no website. And suddenly they show up pouring money into political advertising. So it's pretty transparent, isn't it, what the purpose of these dark money 501c4s and PACs are?
It's hard to deny that these groups often exist for the purpose of influencing elections without the donors having to show their faces. And unfortunately, in the current regulatory environment, there just are a lot of ways for big donors to do that. There's not good enforcement. The Supreme Court has sort of deregulated certain things, and Congress hasn't stepped in to fix it, and the agencies haven't stepped in to fix it.
And you can basically, you know, call yourself the committee for mom and apple pie and pour in millions and millions, and if you do it after October the 15th, who's going to know?
Right. I mean, you can even, you know, even ignoring that issue, you can call your, you can set up a nonprofit in a form that was never designed to spend on elections and call it something similar, you know, Americans for a Better America, and you can start spending the January before the election, and no one will ever know where that money comes from. Even, you know, the next year when the tax returns are released, the identities of donors can still be hidden.
So what's your sense then of how much this is working, Ian Vanderwalker? Again, he's the counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and he is the lead author of a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, Outside Money and Dark Money in Toss-Up Senate Races. I mean, clearly, first of all, we don't even know that the results of this Senate race on Tuesday will be clear until January 2015 if Michelle Nunn in Georgia doesn't get an outright majority, and also in Louisiana, if Mary Landrieu doesn't get an outright majority, that won't be decided until December. So there's a possibility that if the candidate, the independent candidate in Kansas, Greg Orman, wins, he may not declare who he's going to caucus with, and the whole thing is going to be a toss-up until January. I mean, as somebody that works on elections and tries to make reform elections, make voting rights more robust and elections more transparent, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it?
It's very troubling. I mean, one thing, you know, that we don't know who's going to win tomorrow or even if we'll know, but we do know that whoever wins, they'll have had big money behind them because big money is on both sides of all of these races. So whoever goes into the Senate in these races in January is going to have had huge donors spend large amounts behind them, and they will know that fact. And, you know, not to say that, you know, everyone is corrupt or bad, but there's a certain human nature element of if they know that these interests spent all this money favoring them or not favoring them, is that going to affect their legislative activity? And are those big donors going to have more influence than the average voters and the constituents of these elected officials? That's a big concern.
So has anybody done a study, Ian Vanderwalker, on where most of the money goes? My sense is that most of the money that's raised, either dark money or this outside spending PACs, that most of it goes for television advertising. So given that then, isn't it fairly likely or a reasonable assumption to say that the U.S. media monopolies, the big networks, basically don't have an investment in changing the system because they profit from it so enormously? Because if you're in Kansas now, I'll bet you're fighting over buying airtime from whatever television outlets there are in Kansas, and you're probably paying top dollar just to get on the air because you know the airwaves are saturated and somebody's making all that money.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's one of the things that a lot of times Money in Politics reporting doesn't get to is who's making the money. TV stations make an enormous amount of money. And as you say, some of these markets, there are literally no more ad slots left. You know, there's also a big industry of political consultants who are the people who are telling those campaigns that what they need to spend money on is TV ads, even though there's some evidence that you reach a point of saturation and those extra TV ads don't make any difference. So yeah, there are definitely vested interests at stake here, and there's a network of people who are trying to buy influence through spending, and they need something to spend it on, whether it has huge effects on the voters or not. And what the people that are being left out of the whole thing are the public, the general public, the voters and the constituents of these elected officials.
So let's go through the races where records are being broken. North Carolina, Colorado, Iowa, and I take it also Arkansas.
Yes, North Carolina is now has been for some time the most expensive race ever in the Senate in terms of outside spending. It's $78 million spent by interest other than the candidates themselves. The candidates, of course, also have spent a lot of money. You know, the last Senate election in North Carolina in 2010, the whole election, candidate and outside spending, cost only $11 million. So it's a huge difference historically, and of course it has to do with the election being competitive and the Senate being competitive and the Republicans trying to take control of the Senate. But and then there are two other races that already, as of a week before Election Day, have beat the previous record, the all-time record for Senate elections. So the totals keep ticking up and up every election cycle.
Well, in Colorado, again, I think it's broken the records. It's, The headline today, of course, is that Mark Udall, who's struggling, the incumbent Democrat, against a well-financed Republican, one of Udall's millionaire backers apparently embarrassed him at a campaign rally. So, you know, I guess...
Yeah, I mean... That,
I guess my point is that the rich guys, basically, based on the attitude of this guy... Their attitude is, you know, we're paying for you and you got to perform according to us. The guy was complaining that Udall was focusing too much on women's rights and not on other issues.
Right. I mean, that's one of the problems with the current environment, where so much of the money comes from outside. The candidates don't control it. They're not accountable for it. And, you know, these sort of millionaire donors think that they can do whatever they want. And to some extent, the money calls the tune and they can do whatever they want. And they also think that, you know, they have some control over that, or they deserve to have some control over that candidate, and then that elected official who's going to take their phone call when they have an office in the United States Senate.
So in terms of Kansas, my understanding is that there are some dark money organizations literally just being formed, and there is also, of course, the Koch brothers have enormous influence in Kansas. That is where they're headquarters are, but this new group is called the Alliance for a Free Society, and apparently the New York Times did some sleuthing, and it turns out, of course, that if you follow the paper trail, it goes to Delaware to a nonprofit corporation formed in July, and then you eventually figure out that it was put together by a former executive of Koch Industries. So even the billionaires can, you know, basically create these cutouts with their bagmen.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. That's, you know, a lot of these nonprofits are created, as you say, it's just a post office box somewhere and somebody registers it. And it's a wholly owned subsidiary of some corporation somewhere or some billionaire somewhere. And the public has no idea where the money comes from unless somebody does the kind of detective work that you mentioned. But the disturbing thing is that it's likely that the candidate who runs in these political circles and is talking to big donors all the time does know where the money comes from. So there's a kind of way of exchanging favors and gaining influence that the public and the voters can't keep track of.
And there's, of course, this fiction out there, this legal line that's been drawn between the candidate's campaign and the outside campaigns. They're not supposed to be coordinated. Does anybody believe
right.
that?
Well, you know, it becomes very legalistic when you hear the campaigns talk about it. They say, here's what the law is, and we walk right up to that line, but we don't cross that line. The problem is that that line doesn't have much to do with reality. It allows a lot of cooperation between these supposedly outside groups and the campaign, such that a donor can give $1 million to the allegedly independent group, knowing that every cent of that $1 million is going to be spent on their favored candidate's campaign by people who used to work for the candidate, who are using resources that the candidate posted on their website, And it begs the question, you know, are the contribution limits there, which are only $5,200 for federal candidates, are those contribution limits doing anything? Or is that $1 million to an outside group just as valuable to that candidate and just as corrupting?
So do you think the Roberts Court, the five conservative justices who are largely responsible for this train wreck because of the Citizens United decision, do you think they have any concept of what's happening on the ground with American elections? Because I don't know whether you recall in the State of the Union address shortly after Citizens United came down, President Obama was mentioned what a catastrophe he thought it was. He actually thought that a lot of outside money could actually come from overseas. I'm not sure that that's happening, but it's certainly happening in terms of here in the U.S. And then, of course, Justice Alito, who was in the chamber, famously mouthed, "Not true." What do you think Alito was alluding to there?
Well, I think he... Citizens United, on its face, was a relatively narrow ruling. It just said corporations have the right to spend money out of their, and unions, out of their general treasury instead of out of these segregated funds. But the reasoning of Citizens United was sweeping, and it directly led... So initially there was this sort of idea that, oh, this is a limited decision that just allows people to get together in corporations and spend money. But then the reasoning of it was so sweeping, and it led to other decisions that directly created super PACs and that created this proliferation of outside groups, including the use of nonprofits to spend enormous amounts of money on elections, including dark money, which we don't know where it comes from. It could be corporate money. It could be foreign money. It could be, you know, money from someone who wants to bribe a politician. We just don't know. That's the problem with dark money. So, you know, I think Citizens United, if you read the decision, it's very optimistic in terms of, oh, the spending is independent, so it will never corrupt candidates, and it'll all be disclosed in the days of the internet. We'll all know everything right away. And those predictions just have not come true, and the reality just does not match what the Supreme Court said. Now, the Supreme Court left open to Congress and to the agencies like the FEC that they could change the rules to reflect those realities, and they have failed to do that. So, you know, Citizens United created this mess, but Congress and the agencies have failed to fix it.
And why do you think that is? Because not only the FCC, which is pretty much dysfunctional, I mean, the FEC, which is pretty much dysfunctional, they haven't done a damn thing. But even the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has the authority, for example, to demand that corporations, because of their shareholders, acknowledge their contributions in ads, which, you know, obviously the SEC hasn't pulled that trigger.
No, that's right. I mean, there's been an effort to get the SEC to do that for some years now, and there have been sort of mixed signals from the agency. Hopefully, they will take action on that. But you're right, the FEC is dysfunctional, and to some extent, Congress is dysfunctional. The problem is both that there are, you know, entrenched interests there who have gotten to where they got with the current system, and they don't want to change things. And that makes change difficult, and sometimes, you know, we need scandal, and I think the scandal to create reform, and I think the spending levels and the amount of dark money and the secrecy is rapidly approaching scandal levels, and hopefully it will generate some reform soon.
So do you think at some point then that we're all going to wake up to the unpleasant reality that our politics have been captured by money, and that if you create a system that's based on money, it's logical to assume that he who has the most money captures the system? And that's pretty much what we have, isn't it?
It looks more and more like that every year. I think that's the concern. And that's, you know, it used to be that money in politics was sort of not really talked about very much in the press and not talked about much in elections. And I think it's become much more in the public eye this election as things have gotten worse and worse. And I think that that trend is going to continue, and hopefully it will generate a stronger will for reform. I think, you know, the public is demanding reform, and there are reform ideas out there, like the Disclose Act that's almost passed Congress twice. You know, I think there's motivation there, and it's only going to continue. And it'll be one of the things that people need to look at when there's another Supreme Court vacancy, because these decisions are coming down 5-4, and the next Supreme Court vacancy could potentially shift that dynamic and change constitutional interpretation on these issues for the better.
Right, but if the Republicans control the Senate after Tuesday, then the president is not likely to get any of his nominees through. He hasn't been able to get enormous number of judicial appointments filled in any case. And on the other point we talked about earlier, the press, particularly the television broadcasters, since they're making so much money out of this dysfunctional, money-driven politics, they're not likely to suddenly say we need reform, are they?
No, it's true. I mean, well, I think there are, I think there are members of the press that care about the public interest and aren't as worried about, you know, local affiliates making money. But it's true that there are entrenched interests opposed to reform. That's always true. And it's also true that, you know, we have a great democracy that has the tools to fix itself. And I think that there's organizing and grassroots action around that. And there are policy proposals out there, and you know, we remain optimistic. It's dark days right now, but hopefully there's something better coming around the corner.
Well, Ian Vander Walker, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ian Vander Walker, who serves as counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where he works on voting rights and campaign finance reform. Prior to joining the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, he served as a legal fellow at the Center for Reproductive Rights, where he litigated constitutional cases in state and federal courts across the country. He's the lead author of a new report from the Brennan Center, Outside Money and Dark Money in Toss-Up Senate Races. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and get an accounting of which billionaires will be buying Tuesday's election. What have we done? How did we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. All of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all of the fun. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he is the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. His latest book just out is Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell West.
Ian, it's nice to be with you.
And in September of this year, you also published, along with your new book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, the Billionaire Political Power Index. So tell us about this and how and what kind of methodology you used.
Yeah, so there are a lot of people who track billionaires in terms of their net worth. What I wanted to do was to look at the billionaires' political activism in terms of campaign expenditures, being active through nonprofit organizations, owning news outlets, or general thought leadership. And so we put out an index in September, but of course there's been a lot of things that have changed over the last 2 months. And so today we put out a revised index that takes into account some of the activism that we've seen during the 2014 election.
And this 2014 election is going to be a record-breaking $4 billion election. Where can people get this latest update? We've only got a couple of days left here before the 99% have their say, while clearly the 1% have already had their say.
Absolutely. I mean, the top individuals in terms of wealth have put an enormous amount of money into this campaign. We have a website at brookings.edu/billionaires that kind of outlines what some of these individuals are doing. So, for example, the Koch brothers, it's been estimated they will spend $290 million on this election. And, of course, they're putting a lot of money into those key Senate races, knowing that control of the Senate is at stake.
So they're number one on the list. Number two is Michael Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg has devoted about $50 million to challenging the National Rifle Association. One of the races where he's been very active in recent weeks is the Connecticut governor's race involving Dan Malloy, who, of course, helped to pass stricter anti-gun violence legislation. So Bloomberg is trying to keep him in office, knowing that that is a very close race. Bloomberg also has been very active in Berkeley, where there is a soda tax a referendum that would levy a 1 cent per ounce soda tax.
And number three is Tom Steyer. He's a VC guy up in Silicon Valley, venture capitalist, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's a California billionaire, very concerned about the climate change issue. He's already spent $55 million of his own money to run ads in Michigan, New Hampshire, Iowa, Colorado, Pennsylvania, and Florida, attempting to influence either Senate races or the governor's race, depending on the state.
And then number four, Sheldon Adelson.
Sheldon Adelson continues to spend tens of millions of dollars on elections. This year, he gave Crossroads GPS, which is the Karl Rove organization, $10 million. So that made him one of the biggest contributors to Rove's organization. And so that money is being put into those tight Senate races in hopes of trying to build a Republican majority.
And that's through PAC money. Has he put – we wouldn't know whether he's put dark money through – because Crossroads GPS also has a dark money fund as well.
Yeah, and of course, this is a big problem in tracking billionaire political activism. Like, if they're making a direct contribution themselves, or if they're contributing to a super PAC, the donor does have to disclose the gift. But a lot of these billionaires are active in dark money, meaning they're contributing to nonprofit organizations that do not have to disclose their donors. So unless some news organization somehow has gotten the information, there's a lot of money that's operating below the radar that we don't even know about.
And number five, Rupert Murdoch. So he's certainly got more than your regular, if they say money is speech, well, then he's got an awful lot of speech because he controls so much media.
Absolutely. Just through his ownership of Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, that makes him a very big player. But what I find interesting about Murdoch is, compared to the other individuals, especially the conservative billionaires who are spending tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on direct electoral advocacy and funding ads in the various races, Murdoch does not do that. Now, it may be that he feels he doesn't have to because, he has great influence at Fox, he has great influence at the Wall Street Journal, but he is different from some of the other conservative billionaires in not really doing a lot of electoral advocacy.
And then number six, John Joe Ricketts, not a familiar name.
Ricketts is the founder of the investment firm at TD Ameritrade, and so he made a huge amount of money through that firm. He has a super PAC called Ending Spending, which has been very active in some of the closest Senate races. So, for example, his group just put $2 million into Georgia in order to boost the fortunes of GOP candidate David Perdue over Democrat Michelle Nunn. He also has spent $1 million on the New Hampshire Senate race and $1 million on that very close Kansas race. So he's been very strategic in the sense that he waited later than some of the individuals, but waited until he could see where the closest races were and where he felt his millions could have the greatest impact, and then he has pumped a lot of money into those states. I should also point out that he and his wife Marlene also have a son, Pete, who's actually on the ballot to become governor of Nebraska. And Ricketts and his wife contributed over $1 million to their son's campaign.
But when you say that are they deficit hawks and they're promoters of austerity? Is that what their politics are?
Yes. Ricketts is a conservative billionaire, so he supports a limited role for government, doesn't like a lot of financial regulation, and is very active on the Republican side.
But not a limited role for billionaires getting involved in buying politicians.
No.
Okay.
As far as I know, most billionaires are very liberal in their views on their own involvement in the American election process.
So number seven, Robert to Bob Mercer.
He is an individual who runs an investment firm based in New York, and he has been one of the largest contributors to the Koch-backed super PAC, the Freedom Partners Action Fund. This is a group that has been very active in a number of the Senate races. They put a huge amount of money into North Carolina. They've been active in most of the close races. So he has been one of the largest backers of the Kochs.
And Paul Singer, he's pretty infamous, isn't he? He's the hedge fund billionaire that is basically taking on Argentina and forcing them into default, right?
Yeah, he's been very active on that Argentina debt issue, but he's also active in terms of U.S. Politics. So he's been one of the biggest contributors to American Crossroads. Again, that's Karl Rove's political action committee. The other thing that makes him a little different from some of the other conservative billionaires is, in general, he is very conservative, except when it comes to the issue of same-sex marriage. He actually has a son who is gay. And so on that issue, he's actually spent quite a bit of money trying to alter the platform of the Republican Party. Although, of course, there's not much evidence that he's had any impact in that effort. But it's interesting that, you know, some of the billionaires are a little unconventional in where they're spending their money.
And number nine, Peter Thiel. He's a libertarian, right? A Silicon Valley billionaire.
He is a libertarian. He was a big funder of Ron Paul's presidential campaign in 2012, and presumably if Rand Paul runs in 2016, people expect Thiel to support him as well. But one of the things he did, I tried to look at differing paths by which billionaires can become politically influential. In Thiel's case, he actually is a book author. He put out a best-selling book entitled Zero to One, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future. And when you look at the book, he talks about the value of startups, the importance of entrepreneurship, basically how breakthrough technologies can create great innovations. But, you know, he's a little unconventional in how he thinks about things. In the book, he argues that monopolies are good because they promote change and they promote innovation. And so I put him on my top 10 list, not because he has been so active in the 2012 election, but he's engaging in thought leadership, trying to influence long-term discussions and how people think about some of these kinds of issues.
And number 10 is George and Jonathan Soros.
They, of course, have a long history of involvement on the progressive side. They funded a number of grassroots organizations through their Open Society Foundation. They're very interested in various causes related to social justice, political rights, and HIV prevention. This year, George gave a large gift to the Oregon marijuana legalization effort and also has helped to support Kay Hagan's North Carolina Senate bid. And then George's son, Jonathan, also hosted a fundraiser for the independent candidate in Kansas for Senate, Greg Orman. So the family continues to be very active and very involved. They're not kind of spending the same kind of money that certainly the Koch brothers or some of the other conservative billionaires are doing, but you know, they have put a lot of money into grassroots organizations.
Well, that's just the top 10, and it's interesting to note that only 3 out of 10 are liberal, 7 out of 10 are conservative. The others, now, in terms of who's up and who's down on your list, I take it that some of them are going up, and also some of them are going down, are there not? There's a list of I guess Penny Pritzker, who comes in at number 20. She's with the administration, right? Alice Walton has gone down on the list. Who's the one that's gone up the most in terms of spending?
Well, there were several people who did not make the list that I put out in September because they really hadn't been that active up to that point. But then they became active thereafter. And this was true both on the Republican side as well as the Democratic side. So Joe Ricketts was someone who did not appear on the September list, but then, you know, he's been spending millions of dollars in the various Senate races, so he moved up the list. Bob Mercer, again, another conservative billionaire, moved up the list. Peter Thiel moved up because of his book. And then there are a couple of individuals on the Democratic side. David Giffen, the Hollywood entertainment billionaire, and Jim Simmons, who's a financial Wall Street. Both of them have been active on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the phone's starting to break up a little bit, but just to get it again, because in the first 10, only three are on the kind of liberal side, even though Michael Bloomberg is a Republican, or perhaps you might say a recovering Republican. Seven are conservative. In the overall, the rest of the list, which goes to 24, I take it the same ratio of what, 2 or 3 to 1, conservative to liberal, right?
And this is pretty much what we saw in 2012. Like if you just look at the big money that came into the super PACs, and that was the primary vehicle by which rich people were active in that year. 80% of the super PAC contributions in 2012 came in on the Republican side. So, you know, much more of the big money favored Republicans as opposed to Democrats. This year, you know, we'll have to wait and see, you know, what the ultimate tally shows up to be, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot more spending among conservative billionaires as opposed to liberal billionaires, in part because the brothers' investment is just so huge at $200 million that it kind of dwarfs everybody else and pops up, you know, that number for billionaires money into the Republican Party.
Well, just in closing, what's your sense then of whether this report that you've put out and in your book, Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust, are going to sort of revive America's supposedly traditional sense of egalitarianism and the idea that there's such a thing as the American dream and that this country's a meritocracy?
I mean, I'm hoping that's what both the index as well as the book about billionaires will do. There's been a tremendous amount of interest. We've had over 80 news stories that have appeared about the book. We've had over 100,000 visits to our book webpage. So if people are interested in learning more about kind of the role that big money is playing in the American political process, they can take the book, Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Darrell West.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he's the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. His latest book just out is Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. And you can just go to Brookings' website and type in billionaires, and you'll get this list that he's put together, which is the Billionaire Political Power Index. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.